Welcome to Planet Poetry. I'm Robin Houghton.
And I'm Peter Kenny. And in this episode, we're feeling blissful, with Robin chatting to Jack Underwood about his collection Happiness.
And as it's the last episode of Planet Poetry for 2020, Peter and I are going to be having a chat about some of the poetry collections we've enjoyed this year.
So are you feeling festive, Robin?
We've got a lovely Christmas tree up, but apart from that, is it just me or has it been a bit funny this year?
Christmas is usually my favourite time of all for some reason, but I just want to fast forward through this one. I think it's maybe because of not seeing some of the people I'd like to see normally.
Yeah, that's a big part of it, isn't it?
But I still love it. The things I love about Christmas, weirdly, are things like Christmas lights and just looking at a Christmas tree can make me feel happy.
Oh, I agree with you about the lights. I do love the lights. And carols and singing at Christmas make it for me.
Yeah, for me, Christmas is all about, brings back memories of Guernsey, where I grew up as a child.
Oh, how was that?
It was great. We used to get what they used to call the mail boat over there and often sort of be sailing off in high seas in December and just arrive and you'd sort of get to Guernsey and you'd feel that the earth was going up and down, you know, as you walked around for the first few hours. I just loved it.
Fantastic.
Guernsey was the place of Christmas. So I've got a poem.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, which is quite a cheerful poem from a really uncheerful source, which is Philip Larkin. And it's a poem called Coming. And I quite like it because it's talking about the onset of spring. I know we're a bit far away from that yet, but there is the sense of any day now, the days are going to start getting longer. And so we're on the cusp of something more cheerful, perhaps. So here's old miserable Larkin being cheerful for a moment. Coming. On longer evenings, light, chill, and yellow bathes the serene foreheads of houses. A thrush sings, laurel surrounded in the deep, bare garden, its fresh-peeled voice astonishing the brickwork. It will be spring soon. It will be spring soon. And I, whose childhood is a forgotten boredom, feel like a child who comes on a scene of adult reconciling and can understand nothing but the unusual laughter and starts to be happy. So a little momentary smile across the face of Philip Larkin.
Oh, that was lovely. And I loved the little bit about the thrush. And it's true. I learnt this recently that birds in the winter, if you hear birds singing, then quite often they're not really singing. They're just practicing, apparently. They're just practicing so that when the spring really comes, they give it their full throttle.
Oh. Maybe we should hear your interview with Jack Underwood now.
Jack Underwood is the author of Happiness, published by Faber in 2015, and Solo for Masha Voice in 2018. His second collection will be coming out with Faber in 2021, and next year also sees the publication of his debut work of non-fiction, Not Even This. Jack is a senior lecturer in creative writing at Goldsmiths College in London. Great to have you here on Planet Poetry, Jack Underwood.
Yeah, it's lovely to be here.
We have a loose theme each time, each episode of Planet Poetry, and this one is bliss. So my first thought when I was thinking of bliss was your collection Happiness, because just the title of it makes me very happy. But happiness, is it the same as bliss? What do you think?
I don't think so. I think bliss is kind of has more proximity to the sublime, which is not just, it's kind of like where knowledge meets not just the unknown, but the unknowable, the proximity to the unknowable or the ungraspable or the inarticulable. And I think bliss kind of belongs to that category. It's sort of pleasure taken to such extreme that it's abstract.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. Yet there were moments in the book that I felt you were trying to articulate the inarticulable, that they were moments close to bliss, particularly. I felt that quite strongly. And I also wondered whether the title, happiness was, did you intend any irony? Because a lot of the poems are more about sadness.
Yeah, I definitely intended some irony, because I sort of don't really believe in happiness as a fixable state. I mean, it's also sort of things that when you realize that you're happy, I don't know, that there's an attendant sadness at its own passing, you know, it does not wait to leave, is the sort of way I phrased it in the title poem. I suppose, yeah, the irony of the title is hopefully advertising that the belief that I have that it's never one gear, that there's always some dissonance.
Well, personally, I got a lot of happiness from it. I'm a bit sad that it's more about sadness than happiness. It's also your use of language that makes me smile, you know, because you have such a sort of unexpected turn of phrase. Maybe it's a good time. Maybe you should start with a poem.
Yeah, I mean, maybe one of the happier poems is Inventory of Friends. And I think that that's a poem that kind of, I suppose, celebrates something. So I'll give that a blast.
Great.
Inventory of Friends. I run through the grass-topped lives of my friends. I would like to have his body that is so slender, it looks sponsored by a company from Switzerland. Or that guy's gliding youth, his hopeful wardrobe. I could use a transfusion of shyness to my voice. I know 10 people who are blessings, good people for long car journeys, good people for talking to on steps outside before we go in. Or that 20th century seriousness that he has. I'd like a slice of proper prowess. And I try to imagine having her mind, funny, smart, and odd, as 20 emperor penguins filing through the door of a black limousine, but with a predictability that would be cuteness if it weren't honest first. My thoughts turn to you, and what it might be like to be so quietly impressive as a morning or a factory in the distance. What it might be like not to have a clumsy great self always knocking. What it might be like to be you, coming home in 4 hours' time, with no inkling of the way my insides groan and click like a tired old galleon when you take off your coat like that.
I love that. The odd as 20 emperor penguins filing through the door of a black limousine. Where the hell does that come from? I love that.
I don't really want to give away the identity of that particular friend, because I think it would probably embarrass them. And actually, a lot of the people in that are kind of a combination of one or two different people.
The following of where your mind goes is, you've obviously got a kind of surreal sense in that. There was a long prose poem.
Sally and Rena?
Sally and Rena. I was reading that and I was thinking of, probably because I've been reading him lately, Ben Lerner. This American style of, it feels American anyway, this sort of taking a situation and then extending it ad absurdum until you're kind of wondering where the hell you started. I thought that was really, really interesting and entertaining.
Yeah, I think it is an American thing. I mean, I suppose the forebears might be British, like Virginia Woolf, the way that she can sort of forensically turn over and over a single gesture or thought. People like, I suppose, David Foster Wallace, he sort of forensically analyzes a single thought. I think Lydia Davis does that in a more kind of compact and immediate way. And of course, they're both prose writers. So
it brought to mind that. And also Mary Ruefel, that kind of kind of long, somewhat surreal journeys, doesn't she? They're, a number of these poems, I would say, are unsettling, just when, you know, one's getting into a rosy state of mind, then something sort of hits. I mean, a man is dragging a dead dog. I won't ask you to read that because it's quite disturbing. There are also some, I liked the next poem after that, which was An Avoidance. This sense of, again, a small thing, a short poem where you're kind of wrestling with your conscience, I suppose. And, you know, I read it quite a few times. It really kind of, really felt very strong and moving. Actually, there's so many that I enjoyed, and some that were out and out funny. Like, I thought Theology made me laugh out loud.
I think probably with me, it's like that the humour and the darkness are the same thing, really. Yeah. I mean, humour isn't one gear. I do get asked about, writing funny poems and the role of humour in my work. I noticed that other poets don't get asked about the role of seriousness in their work. You know, it's kind of as if the de facto.
As a reader, it's lovely to find humour, you know. There is something exciting in a serious poetry collection, and there's some humour in it that is actually, as you say, of the dark variety.
Well, I think humour is like, it's often about discord and contradiction. So whether it's like bathos, you move from something very earnest and sublime to something more like homely or visceral. That, I suppose, it can be the shock of the recognition of something shameful can make you laugh, the disclosure of something embarrassing. But I think Patrick Kavanagh talks about blabbing in an essay he wrote about poetry, and he talked about how we have these majority secrets there are things that we all do. There aren't really universal experiences, but when you disclose something that you might be ashamed of, really what you're doing is kind of offering that to the rest of the human community to say, you know, is it like that for you too? And when we recognize something in another person's shame as correlating with our own, you know, we laugh. I think, you know, we're relieved. I don't believe that life is ever one gear, and I don't believe that the names that we put on emotions are adequate. It's always much more complex than that. And the dissonance and the discourse is where it's kind of what poetry reclaims of that complexity.
So when it comes to putting a new book together or thinking about your next book, what do you have a process, or does it take you a while?
I'm very slow, and I was slow with the first book, largely with Happiness, because I was honing my craft, I suppose, or arriving to. I was publishing for probably about, well, let me think, probably a good 10 years of publishing in magazines before the book arrived. And I kind of accumulated and accrued poems, and you have a kind of body of work that's a working manuscript, and you jettison ones that you grow out of, and you accrue new ones and add them in. And so since Happiness came out in 2015, I've been doing that again, really. I think actually I'd probably get quite sick of myself and exhausted, you know, throwing the bucket down and pulling up, you know, dredging up. I'd quite quickly get to the mud, you know.
a lot of water down there.
Yeah, I have to wait for it to. And I think also just like really like digging into those reserves, I'd much rather wait for those kind of poems, the more lyric poems or post-lyric poems, you know, that I write out of my life, not about it. But I still have to wait for feeling and idea to manifest. I do have some sort of more poems that begin more conceptually, or other entry points. So I just need the time really to make that process less artificial and contrived. You know, how many books of poetry are we supposed to write in a lifetime? I mean, goodness.
I know some people are very prolific, aren't they? Others, you know, Philip Larkin, what did he write? Not a lot in a big space of time.
Four, was it? Maybe? Including the early ones?
And Danny Absey, I think, used to say, you know, if he'd written one poem that he was pleased with a year, he's quite happy.
That's not bad. Well, also there's Nicholson Baker's in the, I can't remember what the book's called. It's the sequel to his book, The Anthologist, which is about a poet, and Paul Chowder, the poet in that, says that anything more than five books in a lifetime is vulgar.
I like that. Yeah. That's a good way of looking at it. So tell us a bit about what you've been working on recently, or what you're working on now, what's coming up. And we want to hear some of your newer work.
Yeah, I've got two books coming out next year. One is a nonfiction book, and that's about parenthood. And it's also about uncertainty and how poetry is a kind of way of inhabiting uncertainty. It's a kind of uncertain way of knowing. And it also looks at other forms of knowledge, really different languages and areas and fields of knowledge making, like quantum mechanics or astrophysics.
Well, that sounds very different and bold. Actually, funny you should say it, because we had Katrina Porteous recently on the podcast, and she wrote a collection, Edge, where she basically spent time with the Large Hadron Collider and all sorts of exciting places like that.
Yeah.
She got deep into the whole physics meets poetry thing. So this sounds like a very broad-ranging book. Would you call it creative nonfiction, or?
Yeah.
Not a how-to manual or anything like.
No, it's not a parenting guide. I wouldn't.
I don't think we need that. Expert. We need a parenting guide from poets.
Well, it's a reckoning with the kind of existential, I don't know, the sort of nihilism of parenting, really, the chaos and the self-reckoning that happens with that. And it looks at also, I suppose, uses some kind of anecdotal or lyric essayism about my daughter and things that I realized through observing her and interacting with her about kind of personhood and what and the way that actually, like, our entry into personhood is also, this is mainly, it's about that, that's a process of dulling and reduction, that the way that we know the world habitually doesn't have accuracy in mind. It has efficiency and survival in mind. And I think part of what poetry does is actually, yeah, reclaim from the habitual. It reclaims uncertainty. It sort of says, you know, it reclaims some complexity and says there's more here than the workable, workaday, practical version.
That's fascinating. So what's the name of this book and who's it been published with?
And the nonfiction book is called Not Even This. And it's been published by Corsair, who also published Heather Crystal's brilliant crying book. They also published, they've got a good poetry list too, with people like Morgan Parker, Shane McRae, and Heather Crystal as well. So they've also got a fantastic new book coming out by someone called Joyelle McSweeney, who hasn't really been widely read in this country. And she's a real, her voice is astonishing, really interesting new poet. So they're building a good kind of list of nonfiction. And they also have great short story writers like Jane Fever. They're a really, really good sort of boutique imprint.
Yeah. Excellent. That's good to know.
And then Faber are bringing out another book of poems. I don't know. I haven't entirely settled on the title yet. I think I've got one, but I don't know if I should.
No, don't worry. You don't have to spill the beans. We'll hold you to it if you do.
I'll start with a poem from the new book called My Name is Zonal Coordinator. And I'm choosing it largely because it sort of suits the medium of a podcast, listening on headphones or...
Excellent.
It's a poem about... poem about kind of voice, really, and it combines those kind of guided meditation videos or whatever that you can download. It combines that with kind of the spam emails that you get as well, that are trying to sort of defraud they're trying to get hold of your account numbers and details and stuff.
Very zeitgeisty. Yeah.
So the title of the poem was the first line of one of those phishing spam emails. My name is Zonal Coordinator. Listen to my voice happening inside you. Feel the way I pronounce these words, moving them through you like fruits of different sizes and shapes. Apricot. I'm going to move the word apricot to touch against your liver. Is that okay? Do you know where your liver is? Apricot. There. You found it. You are beginning to feel lighter. You are on a generic tropical beach. Your wisdom teeth are calm and happy. Your family forgives you. You are lava rising through the mantle of the world, oblivious to events upon its surface. Your friends like you. You are floating. My peregrine will guide you. See small adjustments to her wingtips. Nothing is holding you up now. The second digit of your security number has fallen far away. No one is cross with you. The world will return to its natural state of non-existence, but only when you do. Repeat after me. I'm feeling so good about myself. I am feeling so good about myself.
I'm all zoned out now. Reminds me of hypnotherapy, you know, where you sort of, if you've ever had hypnotherapy and the time goes so quickly. And the first time I had that done, I remember coming out thinking, well, that's a complete waste of time, wasn't it? You know, and it turned out that actually it completely worked. I'm completely susceptible to that.
Oh, wow. Thing, so. Well, I have listened to quite a few sort of anti-anxiety meditation, guided meditations, and certainly stolen the intonation and patterning from those. The other poem I'll read a poem called The Landing, which is for my daughter, Nancy Agnes, and who's three now. And I suppose it's I don't know. It's just there's lots of poems kind of about parenthood, but this one is more of a poem. I suppose it's more directly for her. So, The Landing. You come round thinking in a new language of the familiar, your voice dragging at my body still waking, but already I'm on the landing. I'm reaching you, awake now, my hand in the black, finding the back of your sweaty little head. I'm here to settle you again into sleep. And inside, your neat organs are working. Your lungs, I can hear, are filling with the air, the food in your stomach I cooked you today, the piss in your bladder and the shit in your colon, the bile, your pancreas, your liver, the offal of a songbird, neat and dark and busy, and your feet like rare cave mushrooms, your eyelashes and hair, which you've grown from nothing, made for yourself, for your life, by your mother from nothing. And I'm filled with the fear of the joy, no, the sadness of the joy. A leaf on a street, what I mean, if you don't know what I mean, by the sadness of the joy, is forgive me. I mean, don't worry about it for a second, if you don't. But if you do know what I mean, and I'm still alive to tell, please, please come and tell me about it. I'm here. I'm here. I'll never leave this room.
Oh, that is beautiful. The feet like mushrooms in a cave or something.
Yeah. Mushrooms in a cave. A rare cave.
You start with the hand on the back of the head and you can picture, you know, a small child and them. But then you're right inside the body and every single aspect is this visceral kind of summoning up that you've got there, and the hair that comes from nowhere.
Mm. I was reading it, thinking about it just then. I wondered how much in my mind I kind of stolen the shape from Bishop's The Fish, which of course, you know, she catches this tremendous fish and sort of hauls it onto the, you know, and goes right inside the eye and the skin and the little pink peony of the swim bladder and the ribs and all the meat in there. And then of course, like, she rainbow, 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 and she lets the fish go. No wonder.
Well, but in fact, in Happiness, you know, there are several, like I said, several poems that seem to me where you are very much going inside bodies, inside things.
Yeah, I think there is a sort of, it's one of the places that the mind can go. I have this kind of concept or at least I teach the concept of scopics, which is the various kind of scopes that one has. In a poem, unlike, say, a novel, or in fiction, where you tend to be rooted in a location, a single location. And of course, the character's mind can go into memory or fantasy and travel elsewhere. But the location of a poem is the mind already. So you might be in a room, but if the poem is your kind of room, you can travel anywhere.
Jack, thanks so much for talking to us today, and it's been a great pleasure, and have a good rest of the day.
Thank you. You too. It's been lovely to catch up.
So, a great interview with Jack there. Actually, your interview with him has made me kind of reappraise what I thought about his work, because I had his book Happiness for some time, and after listening to your interview with him, I kind of went back and had a quick look at the poems in it. And I'd sort of completely missed the sort of quiet joys of his work, really. It's great to be invited to look again at something that he's done.
Yeah, well, that's nice. You're right. I've often found that I've either been to a reading and heard somebody, or someone has said to me, oh, you should look at this, or they really enjoyed someone's book, and then you go back to it and see something different in it. And that's the sign of good writing, isn't it? There's something new to be got from it each time.
Yeah. I like what he was saying about humour and darkness is the one thing, and humour is about discord and contradiction. It was making me think of, was it Auden that was talking about something like poetry is the clear expression of mixed feelings. I don't know why, you know, little gleams of humour can't be part of it as well. I mean, if you think of, like, I don't know, Hamlet or something, you know, Shakespeare was always happy to put in a bit of humour in the middle of the tragedy, because it sort of made the tragedy deeper and all the rest of it.
Yes, is that, or the sense of the absurd and, it heightens the tragedy, I think. You're right.
Yeah.
There's some very clever stuff going on in Jack's book, I think.
I like that. What was the poem where there's that sort of creaking, somebody comes into a room and inside of him is creaking like a galleon or...
Oh, that's beautiful. Yes, that was a beautiful poem.
I found that quite humorous as well. You know, that it's quite a sort of kind of ornate image for...
Yes, absolutely. He's got some extraordinary words that pop in there that do make you sort of smile.
Mm.
To create pathos or poignancy and for it to be funny at the same time is...
There was a poem you mentioned that you said was quite dark. Was it about the dragging a dead dog?
Yes.
Well, I ended up reading it afterwards. I thought the structure was actually a bit like a joke, you know, because it's describing this person dragging a dead dog along, and then it turns to you as the reader and kind of accuses you because you've begun to imagine what sort of dog it is and, you know, what the scene looks like in your own mind.
Like you've colluded.
And once you've imagined that, you know, what else are you going to imagine? I actually found that quite funny, although it was dark, but then I do like dark things. This thing about, he was talking about scopics as well, this kind of, and saying that the location of the poem is in the mind. Mm. So it's that sort of looking at the point of view that the poem's already existing in the mind. That's the armchair you sit in, and from there you can go anywhere, I suppose. It sort of goes back to a phenomenology, the study of how we perceive the phenomena in the world, in a way. There's a sort of long tradition of it in European philosophy. And it's interesting that that's sort of cropping up in the way, you know, he's teaching now. I liked that idea of, you know, what viewpoint you're going to take when you're starting a poem and what space do you inhabit with it.
Hmm.
I always think of it, because I've written plays and things, I quite often think of my state like a stage, you know, where the poem is actually happening. If they're just happening in the mind, you can go anywhere, which is what Jack was saying.
Hmm. Well, 2020 has been a funny old year, of course, but there's been a fair amount of new poetry, hasn't there, Peter? And I think some collections from 2019 have been, you know, we've got round to reading them. There's always a bit of a delay in reading. You know, I rarely get something hot off the press, but there have been some.
Yeah, some amazing collections this year.
Yeah. Tell us about something you've read and enjoyed.
Well, one of the standout books of the year for me was Reckless Paper Birds by John McCullough, which is published by Penned in the Margins.
Yeah.
I think the sort of title's really good because I don't know if you get this as well, that sometimes when you read a collection, I seem to have a kind of overarching image in my head for the whole collection. And after I've been reading Reckless Paper Birds, I can't help thinking of like a bird with one of those sort of drone cameras on it. Because the point of view in this book just kind of swoops down into situations and ends up kind of looking, you know, into the mouths of trainers, for example, hung on a tree or darting off in unexpected tangents. His language as well is just really rich. There's never a dull moment. It's a very fresh style and it seems effortless, but I can't help feeling it's the product of really enormous amounts of hard work. And a kind of magpie mind that goes off, you know, after sparkling little images and collecting them and bringing them back. And there's all kinds of things from pop culture in there as well.
I think you're right in that he has an eye for, I like your, what was it, magpie like? I think he's very much in that respect. And I think he's very hardworking and hard researching. And I remember there used to be a period when I was still on Facebook and John, you could rely on him to post little snippets of what he's researching, extraordinary names of Japanese sea creatures or something, and there was some little seam of historic detail that he'd come up with and would share snippets of that. As you say, he comes up with these meticulously worked poems.
I'm still on Facebook, and one of the things that really characterizes him, he's constantly bigging up other poets and putting other people's poetry on there and kind of shout outs to people that he's really, you know, a force for good in the poetry world, I think. And so it's so nice to, he won this Hawthornden Prize this year.
Oh yeah, that was a big one, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's been won in the past by poets. I was looking at a list of winners this morning, actually, and people like Alice Oswald and Douglas Dunn and Geoffrey Hill and Ted Hughes have all won it. And also folks like Graham Greene and Hilary Mantel and V.S. Naipaul. So, you know, to win this prize is like a real feather in your cap. And
amazing.
Yeah. And in my more beard-stroking moments, I kind of, it makes me think of this French thinker, Roland Barthes, who wrote this book called The Pleasure of the Text, because I get a sort of, excuse the French accent, sort of jouissance, a sensual joyfulness of reading when you swoop into these poems. There's just a kind of love of language that you come away sort of infected with. And for a poet, that's absolutely fantastic, isn't it? One of the things I love about his work is that a lot of it's set in Brighton, which happens to be where I live as well. So, you know, you get that lovely thing of reading a fantastic poem and realizing it's about your local park. And it's not, you know, that he's parochial in any way at all, but it's just kind of, it's just an added bonus, really. I'm going to read Tender Vessels. I think it's just perfectly kind of encapsulate so many of his strengths. I keep trying to slip away through the crowd, but history won't take its mouth off my body. What was exacted on someone else's softness, his cuttable flesh, is always about to happen here. The vague kinship which exists between tender men glowing with thirst starts in awareness of this. How we're unstitched by tongue prints, resurrections. Standing in a street party, one pride, I saw a figure stomp through, fists raise, and strike three boys. They dropped to the ground, clutching their heads. I witnessed everything, squeezed a stranger's shoulder. Then, 15 minutes on, my body was distracted utterly by the smell of oranges. The unspeakable scrapes a fingernail across my neck. But I can only concentrate so long before I wind up decanting myself into the nearest fizzing light, Instagram, house music. It's like those inventors who tried to devise a spray-on cast for broken bones, created silly string. But there are remedies worse than squirting meters of sticky mayhem across a jubilant face, outcomes bleaker than attempting, despite the scissors, to inhabit this 21st century skin. I live in a dream of plummeting from the earth's tallest building without ever having felt more beautiful. Because I'm not the only one falling. I'm in a crowd, a loose democracy of descent, velocity with its hands all over our bodies, but not enough to stop us gossiping and blowing kisses as we speed through the air together. Reckless paper birds. They will find us with our beaks wide open. That tension between the individual body and its vulnerability and this kind of wild exuberance and kind of relentlessness of being alive.
Yes, there's, everywhere there's that, the sense of touch and the skin, and yet there's also the threat, you know, the guy who went in with his fists raised and and the scratching on the neck. It's very much a sort of pleasure and pain and anxiety all kind of wrapped up in this big confection of beauty and excitement.
People should read Reckless Paper Birds. When I started reading it, I kind of felt, God, this is really the kind of writing that should be happening now in England. I don't know quite what I mean by that, but it just seems so, it's just brilliantly poised between being spontaneous and free and loose and also, you know, really thought through too. He's a really fine poet, I think.
Do you think he doesn't get enough recognition? I mean, we know him very well because he's local to us, but as you say, he's, all his collections have won prizes, and I sort of feel one should be seeing more of him.
Yeah, John for Poet Laureate, that's what I say.
That's right. I'm still very into Deaf Republic by Ilya Kaminsky, even though it came out last year. But it is one of those collections that you just want to keep going back to it because it's, is it a collection or is it a play? Funny, something you said earlier about when you're writing a play and you think you've got this stage and anything could happen on it. And this book is written very much like a Greek tragedy in many respects. It's even got a page at the beginning with dramatis personae, so it's got various characters to watch out for as you go through the book.
Oh, that's cool.
And yet, yeah, and yet it's this, basically it's set in a unspecified town in an unspecified country somewhere in Central Europe, I would imagine. And there is a boy who's deaf. It starts with this scene in the town square where clearly the town is occupied by a, by another country. They've sent their soldiers in and there's a puppet show going on and this little deaf boy is enjoying the puppet show. And then when the soldiers come in, they basically cause trouble. And because he's deaf and he doesn't hear them, he just carries on mimicking them and having fun. And it's a bit of a spoiler, but basically they shoot him.
Oh, God.
And then there's extraordinary unfolding of the townspeople are all in mourning and they are outraged at the soldiers. So they all pretend that they're deaf. Basically, they can't hear any of the orders that are shouted at them or anything. It's just amazing. And you've got various characters that you do get inside of, the puppeteer, and there's various subversive things going on to undermine these soldiers. But it's really moving.
It does sound like a dramatic piece.
Yes, it certainly is. A wonderful book. I just wanted to keep reading it.
Mm.
Another collection from 2019, but I've only just been getting into it, and I've only just come across her, is by Maureen N. McLean. And the book is called What I'm Looking For. She's an American poet, and this is a selected, so it takes poems from her books from 2008 to 2017. And she writes with great, with humour, passion. It's quite sexy. It's just the sort of economy of writing that I particularly enjoy. She uses exclamation marks and things that I would never put in a poem. I'll just read one poem from, which I think gives a bit of a feel for her style. It's called As I Was Saying, The Sun. So as you can guess, that's kind of the beginning of the poem. So
is that S-U-N or S-O-N?
The Sun, S-U-N.
Yeah.
As I was saying, the sun and the moon and all stars you can name are fantastic. It's not cool to be enthusiastic, not chill to say, hey, there's a fucking sun still shining over every goddamn thing, except what happens at night. And even then, when we don't see it, it's there, the sun, like God, but more palpable, less responsible, although both burn. A turning world is flat until mountains and valleys and axes tilt the models men make. If I say abstract, I don't mean ideal, I mean real. The lids of our eyes are fewer than cats. Watch it bear down on us, brute, beautiful fact. And what stuns is a sun stuck in the sky by no one.
I like that. I like that a lot. It lulls you into a full sense of security because as it starts, it's easy to understand and just you think, oh, this is going to be quite straightforward. But I love the way it expands out.
Yeah, sort of goes somewhere else.
Mm.
Also, I think she's a musician because there are references to song, and there's one poem that I was very excited to find a reference to an organ. My other half being an organist, I've always wanted to use the words of organ stops in a poem, but I've never found the possibility of doing so. But here we have the word diapason, which is an organ stop in a poem. So kudos to Maureen M. McLean.
Oh, cool. And actually that was quite a blissful poem in a way, wasn't it? It sort of,
I think it was blissful, yeah. Yes. And wasn't there, and it reminded me, isn't there an Emily Dickinson a poem about the sun? It has that, I should have looked it out. It does have that moment of blissful amazement.
Mm. But that's a kind of transcendent moment of just looking again at just things that are invisible to most people or invisible yes. to us during the, you know, majority of our lives. And every now and again, you do look at something and think, wow, you know, that sky's really blue or something, you know.
So tell us about something else you've read that's new this year, Peter.
I read Poor by Caleb Femi.
Yes.
Which you've bought too as well, haven't you?
I have.
Wow, what a book. I love it because it kind of subverts expectations, because Femi's kind of looking at, he finds almost a bleak, sort of almost romantic beauty in, you know, the concrete of these Peckham estates. And his poetry is just, I think on the blurb, it says something about him being a natural storyteller. Every poem is like a sort of, you know, mini epic. And these are stories that haven't really been told. This is somebody from the inside finding beauty and a kind of a wonderful, almost kind of mythic tragedy and beauty and transcendence in it. And, you know, I think a lot of readers coming to it will have their expectations turned upside down. And the events that create these kind of big knobbly stories are not necessarily huge things. Like there's a poem called 13, for example, and it's writing about a 13-year-old being stopped by the police because he looks like a man that's just committed a crime. And that 13-year-old is remembering when the same policeman came to his junior school, or when he was at primary school, and talked to them about being little stars. And the poem ends, I won't read the whole thing. It says, "Don't you remember me, you will ask. You gave a talk at my primary school. While fear condenses on your lips, you will remember that Wednesday after the assembly, your teacher speaking more about supernovas, how they are, in fact, dying stars on the verge of becoming black holes."
That is a powerful poem. I'm actually only about a third of the way through.
Yeah.
I thought it was extraordinary as well, the language, and, you know, thinking, oh, what does that mean? What does that mean? But after a while, you get into the rhythm of it and you start to sort of piece it together, and you're in the world, I think, as much as one can be.
But the photography, you know, both of the environment, and that's what I find, one of the things I find so interesting about it is the way in which he describes the environment and is quite positive about it as well.
Yeah.
There are many poems about concrete, for example, that run as a thread kind of underpinning the anthology. And I just think this is just a massive book in all different ways.
There are a number of poems called Concrete, aren't they? Numbered.
Mm. This one, Concrete, the first of them. Concrete. "I have nothing to offer you but my only pair of Air Max 90s. In principle, they are my autopsy laid out in rubber and threading. Take with them God's speed through the valley of days, low yielding and laughs, where the grey of the concrete is louder than your outfit. I know it can only do so much to cloak you from boydom, so keep this in mind. You don't have to run faster than the police. You just have to run faster than the slowest person. Slip the slope of your ankle into the canvas. May it lift you up 7 feet tall so that they know a lighthouse is on the ends. And when you walk, walk proud, for you walk in what I might have been." Anyway, it's well worth checking out. He was the Poet Laureate for London, and this is his first collection, but it's an absolute stunner, so God knows what he's going to come up with next.
I feel like I've just not been exposed to any of his work before, which seems strange, especially as he was London Poet Laureate.
I think I've seen his name around a little bit, yeah. In fact, it shows how sort of middle class I am. I read a review of it in The Guardian, and I thought, wow, that sounds really interesting.
He took all the photos as well, so he's a photographer as well as a writer.
Yeah.
That might be in line for, we might hear more of that next year.
It's from Penguin.
Penguin, yeah. Yes, we haven't been mentioning publishers, have we? But never mind. Deaf Republic, that was Faber. This year's been difficult, I think, for poets who've had new collections out. They haven't been able to have live readings or launches. It's all been a bit low-key.
Yeah, I've been to a few Zoom launches.
Me too. Yeah. What do you think of that?
I don't know. I kind of get distracted. And when you can see that, because I like to see who else is there.
It's true. Every now and again, I find myself flicking through who's not got their camera on. And yeah. This Zoom thing brings all of its own distractions and annoyances. But at least it is a way to hear poets. And I quite like the idea of poets reading from their sitting room or whatever.
Yeah, I like that very much. You know, and when you're at a reading, I tend to be staring at the person that's reading it or directing all my ears at them. And I think there's a sense of responsibility about being in the audience when you're at a you know, you've got to behave well. And, whereas you can be in a Zoom meeting playing with your cat under the desk or whatever while you're supposedly listening.
I think that's true. And I think it's nice you can always go away, get a drink, come back or whatever. And
at least we've had lots of time for reading. But I've actually found a lot of the, off and on, I've found myself feeling quite twitchy and actually, you know, reading serious things has been, you know, I've had to really force myself to sit down and, you know, work for focus. When we were talking to Pascal, you know, a few episodes ago, she was saying, I think she says she's written one poem this year.
Yeah.
And I think it has kind of, for a lot of people, it's interfered with that kind of normal rhythm of reading and writing. It's ironic, isn't it? We've had more time than ever to sit around reading, or many of us have.
And yeah, it's very hard to just do something because, you know, oh, I've got loads of time. I'm going to write a poem. It's like, oh, I don't know about that.
After your 16th lockdown poem, you kind of...
Well, have you... I mean, I know there have been all these sort of quickly pulled together lockdown poetry anthologies and things, but I'm not the slightest bit inspired to write about this lockdown. Not now. And who knows, maybe not in the future, possibly.
Well, yeah, I found myself writing one, a really bad poem about it, and it ended up being all kind of rhetorical and like a really fifth-rate W.B. Yeats or something.
I have written bits and bobs, something about seagulls, you know, starving because no one's leaving their fast food on the ground for them.
So we'd like to say a huge thank you to you for listening to the Planet Poetry podcast. We've had great fun making it, and we are back with our next episode on the 7th of Jan. So we're taking a short break over Christmas. And Peter's going to be interviewing Mario Petrucci, so don't miss that. Have a lovely Christmas.
Merry Christmas.